Hey, Justin.
Yes, David.
I've come up with a way to save the TV industry.
And what is that?
A podcast all about TV shows and the people that make them happen.
Good. When are we going to start it?
10 seconds ago. This is TV Show and Tell. Welcome to TV Show and Tell, your moot to the elephant traps of the television industry. I'm David Bodycombe. I'm an entertainment producer and games consultant from London.
And I'm Justin Scroggy, a TV content specialist known internationally as the Format Doctor.
And our special guest today is Julia Hobbs, who is one of the UK's leading question producers. She talks to us about the whys and wherefores of supplying the insatiable demands of quizzes such as The Chase. And our two main talking points today are about fairness, about how you make questions fair for the contestants, and how you structure episodes and series so that they are fair. But first, it's time to go to the news headlines with Justin, who's about to shuffle his papers on the desk.
Shuffle, shuffle. So my first story is about a crossover. So I always think that television shows kind of reach a high point of confidence when they start to cross over with other TV shows. So one of my favorite X-Files episodes I remember was called X-Cops, and it was a crossover between the X-Files and the police emergency services follow-up called Cops. And in the Cops episode, they're investigating a mysterious murder, series of murders. And Mulder and Scully are there because they think, maybe, that the murderer is a werewolf. And it was very clever because it wasn't shot in X-Files style. It was shot entirely in Cops style, you know, very much kind of live as it happens, but with Mulder and Scully as two unwelcome parts of the investigation.
Mm.
And, you know, we've seen kind of all the CSI and Law and Order somewheres have crossed characters. We've had Casualty and Holby crossover. In the UK, we've also had, I think, The Office crossed over with the US Office. So David Brent applied for Michael Scott's job and turned up in the US Office, you know, for an interview. But I think this week there might be a TV first. I don't know. But the emergency services drama 911 is crossing over with The Bachelor.
Right.
Okay. So it's quite an interesting thing. This is for the 100th episode of 911. So the plot line is that the host of The Bachelor, Jesse Palmer, calls 911 because a Bachelor super fan super glues himself to the driveway of the Bachelor mansion.
Right.
And the drama series characters from 911 come out to investigate and to try and unglue him, and the plot kind of unfolds from there.
So let me get this straight. Is this part of the reality show or part of the drama? Who's actually getting to show the episodes?
The drama. So it's an episode of the drama 911.
Right.
And it's the real people from the reality show The Bachelor who are playing themselves in it.
Right.
Effectively, but to a script.
I think there's been the occasional thing when a Big Brother contestant's got to be an extra on a soap opera or something like that in various territories.
Well, but as a Big Brother, as themselves, though.
Not really as more anything meaningful. I think the ultimate version of this was when ER in the final episode was revealed to be all the dream of a boy called Timothy. But because Timothy had also been watching about 15 different dramas and soap operas, that means in theory, all of those were also fictional and part of a dream. So there's like this like entire network of highly popular shows that if you believe that story to be true, it means that also about half of American television at the time was also fictional.
That's amazing. I think the weirdest and brilliant one that I've seen most recently was Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which did a crossover with Star Trek Lower Decks. which is animated. And so they had the two characters, animated characters, from Star Trek Lower Decks who investigate this strange portal on a planet and find themselves beaming up to the Starship Enterprise in real form. As the these two characters' animated image actually matched their real, how they really look in real life, they were then able to play real versions of their animated selves. and in the final scene, so that was funny enough, and that played through for the episode. And in the final episode, final scene of the episode, it works the other way. And all the real cast from Strange New World end up on the animated Enterprise when they try to send them back, and it doesn't work. they all end up as animated characters. It sounds ridiculous, but the previous week, the whole show had been a musical. So on that basis, it felt quite normal. And well, I do remember an episode of Magnum PI as well, where Magnum, the private investigator, Tom Selleck, gets accused of murder, and Jessica from Murder, She Wrote turns up to to clear him. So, I mean, but like I said, I think the reason I mentioned it really was because I think it's this question of confidence. I think the X-Files was at its absolute peak at that moment when it did the crossover. And I just think it shows the same with Strange New Worlds, which is just kind of opening and opening and opening with confidence. And it just shows that kind of, yeah, we've got this, you know, we've really nailed this show, what it's about, who these people are, and we can afford to play. And I just love it when shows reach that point.
They often do this sort of thing on April Fool's Day in America. So there's been numerous times when, for example, the host of Wheel of Fortune has hosted Jeopardy, and the host of Jeopardy has hosted Wheel of Fortune, right, and things like that.
I did check the dates on that story. I was halfway through writing up my notes and thinking, hang on a second. It's the beginning of April. This was last week. Maybe I'm really about to announce an April Fool's, but great.
So the streaming service Nebula has announced that they have commissioned a number of things, but most of interest in the non-formatted space is a show called The Getaway, which is the follow-up to Jetlag, a show I've mentioned several times. And details are a little sketchy, but essentially six YouTube creator type people have been put in a camper van, and they're going to go around the American Midwest. And it seems like there's going to be some kind of either Survivor or Genius Game type stuff going on, where it's a social deduction game of sorts. But it's an interesting one, because essentially I find interesting about Nebula is that it's sort of the old fashioned way of getting stuff commissioned, in that they came up with a good idea. They went to the boss of Nebula, it's a guy called Dave Whiskers, and he just said, well, you know, you've made Jetlag such a success, I'll commission it, whatever it is, pretty much. And I think this sort of leaner, faster, easier method of commissioning is something that television can really learn from, because it's like, you know, if you're in your 20s and you just want to make stuff and you've got YouTube at disposal, you can just stick your stuff out there. Why on earth would you go through the infamous double tick commissioning system?
And you could afford to fail as well. I mean, that's the thing. You know, now in television, you can't afford to fail. It's such a big deal. Whereas, as you say, you stick it out there. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. You've learned from it, and you go make something else, which, again, is how, at least to a certain extent, it used to be in some areas of television.
Yeah, famously, there was a music executive in the 60s who would say, you know, do I know if this music is any good? I don't know. I'm a middle-aged man. But, like, it would just stick enough stuff out there and hope some of it sticks. And, like, I think that, yeah, it's a shame that that kind of experimental approach. We should do a topic about how weird some early TV shows were, because some of them were just plain weird, but some of them had extremely novel ideas that were we think that formats today are really brave, but there were some very, very innovative shows back in the 60s, particularly. So we should revisit that at some point. Anyway, just that was a heads up. I think the Getaway could be something to watch.
Sure, great. Another thing to look out for in the future is a show called Skydive Quiz. From
the name's on the tin, really.
Yeah, exactly. It. Yeah, so I'll just stop there. No, as you might imagine, it's a quiz show where the contestants are in a plane, quite a long way up. I think 15,000 feet up, and the questions only start when they jump out of the plane. There's about 3 seconds between leaving the plane and the parachute opening, and they've got to answer the question before their parachute opens.
Oh, okay.
That's the premise of it. Now, that does seem to me that I haven't seen the whole show yet, so it does seem to me that there's now a very long period of time where they've got to get to the ground, where they're presumably not answering questions. So it seems to be quite a jump-out-of-plane-intensive way of running a quiz. But it did remind me of that roller coaster format. Do you remember that one?
Can't get off. Scream If You Know the Answer.
Scream If You Know the Answer, that was it, yeah. Scream If You Know the Answer, which I really liked, actually, because it was fun on the basis that, unlike jumping out of a plane, you're on a roller coaster for a long period of time, relatively speaking. And it just plays into that trope of a number of different TV games where you're trying to do something while you're being distracted massively by something else. In this case, on a roller coaster. And of course, you've got all the visual expressions and all the people trying to answer what is a relatively simple question at home when being terrified on a roller coaster. So it feels to me like it's in that tradition. Again, it feels like one of those kind of gimmicky shows that I can't honestly see where it goes unless they start throwing them out from higher and higher up.
Yeah, I mean, this just to make clear, this hasn't been commissioned. It's just it was a pitch tape, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they're clearly hoping that it's going to. Well, it's from ZDF, so you know it's from a broadcaster. So I think it's a bit of a suck it and see type of show, but there we go.
And then finally, just to mention that ITV have commissioned a local version of 99 to Beat, which is it is a kind of a rinse and repeat format, almost to an extreme extent. It's effectively 100 small tasks, and then whoever is the last person to finish the task is eliminated. So I saw the Dutch version. Task one was that there was a ball pool, and there was 99 yellow balls in the ball pool. Right. So everybody had to sort of leap in, grab a yellow ball, and come out. And obviously the person that didn't have a ball at the end was the one that got eliminated. Then you might have to, like, say, build something and get it to a certain height, or make a paper airplane, throw it a certain distance, or whatever. And so they were all relatively small-scale things because from a production point of view, you obviously had to buy up to 100 of the thing in order to give everybody a fair shot, because you're doing all of these tasks all at once.
Another 100 rounds, then.
Yeah, but what's quite good about it?
How long does it last? Is it one of these four-hour German shows?
It's not quite. I think they fit about 10 of these things in about an hour. So each one only lasts about 4 minutes or so. And the meta of it is that because sometimes certain people keep dodging a bullet several times, although there are 100 people to keep track of, you do start to see certain faces again and again and again until either they keep succeeding or eventually they probably will fail. And you sort of go, oh, I like that person, shame that they've gone. But then there might be somebody else you start caring about. So,
and is this a stripped show? I mean, but even at 5 minutes ago, that would still be 200 minutes of play. So,
oh yeah, it's episodic. So
it's episodic. So, okay, right.
You have about 10 of them in an episode.
Oh, I see. Right, okay, that's a bit of a relief. Yeah,
there's like 10 episodes.
The thing that I'm never quite sure about that kind of structure is if it's always the person who does worst that goes out in each episode, then the person who wins, they just need to not, in any given game, be the worst in any show, which always seems to me to a slightly odd way of winning a prize.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's like Bake Off, isn't it? The person that gets voted off Bake Off is the person that did the worst cake. And any credit you got for being star baker doesn't really help you avoid being eliminated in the next week.
Maybe just it feels rawer in that type of structure. But yeah.
Anyway, we should be maybe looking at fairness and competitions later in the show.
Yep.
What makes a good quiz question, and what are the pitfalls of writing them? Julia Hobbs knows all. She's been a top question producer and writer for shows such as The Chase, Pointless, Tipping Point, Million Pound Drop, and 15 to 1. Julia also has an interesting personal story about how she came into the business. Let's hear from her now. And I'm delighted to say Julia joins us now. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, you have come in to TV from a quite lateral direction, I think it's fair to say. Were you initially in finance, is that right?
I was working for a credit ratings agency in the city as an administrator to a team of credit analysts, doing all of their travel bookings, fee letters, invoicing, all of that stuff. Yeah, and I was made redundant from that position after 7 years and sort of found myself with a bit of, what am I going to do now? And I was lining up job interviews for similar things, you know. But 9 days after I was given my redundancy notice, I went and recorded a quiz show because that was one of my little hobbies that I like to used to do on the side, go on to quiz shows.
What sort of things did you go on?
I had been on 15 to 1. The original William G. Stewart incarnation. That was the first thing I ever went on in 1997. I'd been on The Weakest Link. They were the main ones that I'd been on. Oh, I'd done The People's Quiz 2007, which was a big one that only went for one series. Sadly, didn't win, but did make it to the final. So, you know. And then, as I say, 9 days after being given redundancy notice, I went and recorded a show called One Versus 100, which was a big Saturday night lottery show, at that time presented by Ben Shepherd. They'd done a couple of series presented by Dermot O'Leary, then he left and went to did something else. So I went on that with Ben Shepherd and found myself winning.
How much did you win?
£61,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the problem with being a contestant on things is you can't really make a career out of it, because once you're a known face, then that's kind of like you're burnt, aren't you?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think for a little while I was getting cast, partly because I had form and partly because I was female. Women were not very well represented in TV quiz at that time, let's say. So being a female got me halfway there in most of the things that I applied for. And I was quite lucky to get cast so quickly after being on People's Quiz 2007 as well, because this all happened in early 2008. So I went on this Saturday night lottery quiz, and I knew one of the producers from having been on the People's Quiz 2007, just managed to beat the 100, take the £50,000 bonus, plus what was in my bank at that point, and £61,000, which was rather nice at a very lucky time for me. Yeah, so, and that's sort of where it all started to change.
So from there, how on earth did you end up working on the other side, turning like poacher turned gamekeeper?
Well, at some point during my contestanting, let's call it, I don't know if anyone else has ever turned contestant into a verb, but
you just have, but roll with it.
There we go. at some point during that, I'd had a conversation with this producer called Luke Kelly. I'd sort of mentioned to him that I was interested in question setting, and I'd done a little bit before. I had a little go at writing questions professionally for something called 24-Hour Quiz, which was, it was like Big Brother, but quizzing, basically. It was all these people shut in a house. And I would really have loved to have been a contestant on it, but because I'd put myself in the firing line for question writing, I obviously couldn't do that. But that was really my first taste of having a go at writing questions professionally. It paid peanuts, but it gave me a bit of experience. And I was quite interested in doing a bit more of that. And so I'd had a conversation with Luke Kelly. And he'd sort of locked it away, remembered. And after I'd been on One Versus 100, I had a lovely year off work, did a bit of travelling around, went to South America. And at the end of that year, I heard from Luke, who was at that point working on the rebooted version of Going for Gold for Channel 5, went out live at lunchtimes, presented by David Suchet. And they, not David Suchet, John Suchet.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a question writer at that point. So he asked me if I wanted to have a go. And I sent a sample set of questions into him, had an interview with the series producer in January 2009, and I started working for them. And that was my first question writing job.
Shame it wasn't David Suchet, because he could get an awful lot of mileage out of Little Grey Cells and all that kind of
thing. Yeah, indeed, he could, yeah. Shame it wasn't him, but no, it was John.
Maybe they just said, get me Suchet in to do this quiz show, and then the wrong one turned up. I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah. Maybe.
So just sort of taking a slightly broad sweep across the sort of shows you've worked on, things like Tipping Point, The Chase, Pointless, these are all very, very popular shows. But I think the common thread between them all is that they cover both the sort of the very basic questions and also extraordinarily difficult ones. It all is part of the same package. You know, you have some sort of things like what colour is a sunflower, but also which psychologist came up with the concept of cognitive dissonance in 1873 or something like that. You must have a lot of range.
What I sort of learned quite close to the beginning of my career as a question writer is that you use what you know to start off with, and then you spread that out across other areas. So you can start with a fact that you know or you've heard and you think, well, that might make a good question. And then you can come up with things in a massive range of, you know, about one fact can feed you lots of different things.
Give us an example. Yeah.
never think of any examples. People ask me all the time, what's the favourite question you've written? And I sort of go, oh, I don't know, because you get to a point when you're writing so many that they're in your brain and they're gone. As soon as you've written them and sourced them and sent them out to the verifier, you're on to the next one.
Right.
I think also being a quizzer myself has helped massively, because I can sort of, you know, things I learn, things that soak into my brain, I can, you know, repurpose them and turn them into questions. So I find questions everywhere I look, when you're writing, when you're reading, when you're watching TV. And so, yeah, that it helps a lot to be a little bit interested in a lot of different things.
Speaking personally, I think I'm quite a good quiz writer. I don't think I'm a particularly good quizzer. I kind of like would be able to be okay, I think, at the quiz league, but I would be nowhere near the top at all. Do you actually prefer the writing side or do you prefer the playing side?
It depends. I do love to quiz still. I still play in the Quiz League of London. And my team have just missed out on promotion by a point this season. So I'm...
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I'm putting that down to the fact that I couldn't play the last match because I was recording a new show in Glasgow. I'm not saying that it all rests on me, though. No, I really do enjoy playing the quiz. And I play every week in a Sunday night pub quiz that's quite... You know, it's very friendly and very, you know, you don't pay to play. You only win a box of chocolates. And my team seems to win every week and everyone hates us. But we just really go for the social side of it. It's all good fun. But writing questions, I mean, I don't do as much writing as I used to now as a producer.
Right.
But a well-crafted question still gives me a little bit of, I know it sounds a bit cheesy and a bit rubbish, but it does sort of give me a little bit of a shiver, if you know what I mean. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, I really like that, that works. And if it covers all the bases that you need it to cover for the particular show you're working on, that sort of adds to the sense of pride that you get, really, I think.
Let's talk about that crafting, because I mean you're right. I mean, a good question is like a good joke. It's got that kind of shape and rhythm and whatever to it. But what do you think the craft is? How do you craft a question?
I think about the presenter that's going to be asking the question. That actually does play quite a big part, because you've got to be able to hear them saying it and write it in a way that would make sense for them. For example, on The Chase with Bradley Walsh, he hates alliteration. Absolutely hates it. And he's not a big fan of saying which. He likes what's. Even when which is more grammatically correct, he prefers to say what, because he thinks it's more sort of universal and the way people naturally speak. And all of the presenters you work with, obviously, they all have their own little works.
Do share.
That's the biggest one, really, that I've got is Bradley. Not like he hates alliteration. Right. And, you know, you've also got to try and keep it succinct but tight at the same time. And that is something that you've always got to be thinking about. Sometimes, obviously, you can't get things through verification for various reasons, but it's not necessarily because your question isn't tight enough. It'll just be because there is just something else that someone else won't have thought of that, you know, comes into play.
Because on a lot of your shows, the questions are in graphics on the screen.
Mm.
So in that, like, 30-word space, you've got to be interesting, entertaining, and accurate in just that little sentence.
It's tricky. You've got to bear all of those things in mind. I mean, the show that I've just come off is a new BBC show called The Answer Run. You'd have a category that had two options, and every single answer was one of these two options. So you'd be faced with a number of statements or questions to which one of these options was the answer. And we had, for example, Machu Picchu or the Taj Mahal. And one of the options was occupies a larger site area. So you'd obviously have to make sure that, firstly, that could be verified. And secondly, that the contestants know what you mean by a larger site area. So are we just talking about the building itself? Are we talking about gardens, grounds? What's the perimeter, etc.? And what is included within that? So you've got to be clear about what that means.
Hmm.
In this particular case, it's quite clear. It was easily verified and we didn't have to add anything to it. But there might be instances where you'd have to say, including its gardens occupies a larger site area, or including its entryways or something like that. There might be other things that you'd have to add in to make it clearer.
Right.
So that's something you've always got to be thinking of. And you've always got to, once the verifiers had a look at it, if they're okay with it, then obviously you don't have to do anything to it. But if not, you've got to add whatever bits and pieces you need to. And sometimes that can make the question too wordy, too long, too complicated. You know, it might just take things out of play that you've thought it was a beautifully crafted question when you've written it and it's did everything that it needed to do. But then, of course, the verifier comes along, gets their fingers on it, and it becomes a much tighter question, much more factually accurate and so on, but just no fun at all to use in a TV quiz show. So that, you know, many times I've had the life sucked out of a question by a verifier. We had one that was about Prince's 1999 in a question that was 1999 or 2001, and the verifier actually put a note on it and said, it's my job to take the fun out of your questions, but you have to be writing this way. And in the end, we didn't use it. Because it was just, yeah.
Staying on the kind of the crafting of it, you talked about how the contestant receives the question.
Mm.
So presumably there's also, you need to think about where the key parts of that question land,
mm-hmm.
so that you don't get, if it's against the clock, for example, you don't get interrupted after two words, but also that we're watching the contestant listening to the question as well. So we want to see their thought story play out as well.
Yeah. Well, obviously, if we're writing questions for the buzzer, which is something else I've had to do recently, you want to try and put the meat of the question, as it were, at the end.
Yeah.
So that you avoid that early buzz. But multiple times people do buzz in because they think they know where the question's going and it goes somewhere else entirely. And sometimes that's what you want. You want to write a swerve so that you sort of put them off and get a slightly different result. But sometimes, more often than not, in fact, that's not what you're going for. You do want the straightforward answer. And on the chase, Beat the Chasers, for example, there was a time a couple of series ago, someone answered too quickly to a question about the atmosphere of Venus, I think it was. And the answer he gave was incorrect because he hadn't waited and listened to the end of the question. And a similar thing happened to Paul Sinner when we were asking a question about a Patrick Swayze film that had transferred to a musical on the West End stage. He answered Dirty Dancing. What we actually wanted was Ghost, but he'd jumped in with the answer before Bradley read the date out on the question, which is what tightened it to it being Ghost. In both of those examples, people wrote in and complained about, you were wrong, it was Dirty Dancing, it wasn't ghost, and you were wrong to deny that player the question about Venus, because he was actually right, and we had to then, you know, that's another part of my job, is responding to viewer complaints and queries about the questions, and we had to explain actually that's not where the question was going. If he'd waited, the question actually had a date stamp in it.
I believe you worked on not just several years on The Chase, but also the Australian version. So I wanted to ask you about your experiences of effectively writing for a different culture, even though it's the same language, it's a different culture.
Yeah, that, I mean, and I was surprised actually at how different the Australian Chase was from the UK Chase in its approach to questions. They were much more detailed and in-depth in there. They sort of have an extra layer, if you like, of checking and sort of nitpicking, if you like. And some of the things that came back from the AP that would look at my sets were a little bit kind of like, yeah, I don't think anyone would read that into it, but you sort of have to take it on board and adjust as you see fit. And some of the changes you could just go, no, I don't think that's relevant. But it was quite interesting. You know, I did a pilot series for Tipping Point Australia as well. So I sent, since leaving The Chase, I seem to have become Australian quiz go-to. And knowing what Australian people know off the tops of their head is quite difficult, because I don't live there. I've never been there. I don't know how easy they would find a question about a UK sitcom or a UK soap opera, because I don't know if they watch it over there. Similarly, I've watched Australian TV shows, and I would assume that everyone in Australia has watched these shows, but you just never know. So Australian sports as well. I mean, sports is one of my weakest areas anyway. Throw Australia into the mix and I've got no clue at all. So I'm kind of writing Australian sports questions going, is this easy? I don't know. Who knows this stuff? And then, of course, I get feedback from the Aussie producers saying, oh yeah, this is easy, everyone knows this, or no one in Australia will know this. So it's, yeah, you've got to sort of make a bit of an adjustment in your head, and it's quite tricky.
We had a contestant on Only Connect once who said that she'd been on the Australian version of University Challenge.
Wow.
And Victoria Corrin said, what was it like? And she said, well, it's broadly the same, except there was a lot more questions about sheep. I suppose that's one way of it.
One way of looking at it.
That's upset our Australian listener.
Yeah. Listener, singular.
Yeah. So, and another bit of news, it's been announced that the Stephen Fry version of Jeopardy is going to be launched in Australia, but it's still had a series here in the UK first with him. But Justin, you said that you'd spotted something about the American version recently.
Yes, there's a bit of controversy about what fans perceived to be, or some fans perceived to be, an unfair clue. So it's during the invitational tournament, so former champions and so on, the three contestants, Arthur Chu, David Madden and Mackenzie Jones. And it was the second daily double, so quite a significant part of the competition. Mm. And Chu had a chance to get quite a long way ahead, betting $10,000. And it was a video question. So he was shown a stringless violin, and the text read, it describes someone weakened by nerves and also the instrument here. So a stringless violin, video of that, and the text said, it describes someone weakened by nerves and also the instrument here.
So is unstrung? Is that
is right. Very good. Oh. That is excellent.
Wow. Okay.
You win $10,000. No, that's very good. But even on the show, the host said, so Shu didn't get it. And the host, Ken Jennings, said, well, he had to notice that the violin was unstrung. That's tough. And there were many fans online who just thought that was a terrible, terrible clue. One said they couldn't even see the violin was unstrung when they were watching the TV at home. And also another person pointed out that because it was the Daily Double, the clue, if it was a poor clue, cost the guy a spot in the semis. So yeah, it kind of it just brought up the point about, you know, when is a question fair and when is a question not fair.
Yeah, that question is an interesting one because they tend not to rely on the picture in that sense that when they're doing a clue. The Daily Doubles have got a lot of pressure on them because they are in the modern. I'm putting modern in quotes because it is a strategy that they have used in previous decades. The contestants on that show, but the ultra modern way that people have been using the Daily Doubles is to sort of basically go all in, because if you manage to find both Daily Doubles and you get them both right, because let's say you're 70% likely to get it right anyway because you're a good player, then it's pretty much impossible for anybody else to catch up. The way that they decide Daily Doubles is one which just looks like it's a really good clue that's gettable. And obviously that attracted
the eye of that particular. I mean, I guess it comes down to the fact that you have to write off camera, you know, you have to write your rules and then you have to try and stick to them. I remember there was an episode, again in the States, of Wheel of Fortune, which has a kind of hangman element to it. And the quote that the person was trying to find was seven swans are swimming.
Yes.
And she got most of the letters in and she said, I think I know it. And she said, seven swans are swimming. Now that's because from the area of America that she was from, the natural accent was not to articulate the G. But because she hadn't articulated the G, they didn't allow it as a correct answer. Because she said swimming instead of swimming, she lost a lot of money in the process, and they stuck to it.
We have a thing sometimes on Only Connect when contestants from Scotland complain about wall categories, because one of the categories might be they all sound like something. Uh-huh. Well, they do in RP, received pronunciation, right, aka the Queen's English. But if you speak with a particular dialect or accents in Scotland, they sound nothing like each other in terms of how you would say them in everyday parlance. Yeah. So it's a thing that affects word games and crosswords, and it's not a new thing, but yeah, it's something
that I never thought of that. You're right.
To be a little bit aware of.
Yeah.
Just widen this out a little bit in terms of that. How do you decide whether a question's fair or easy or difficult? It's quite an interesting thing. I did some question writing for 15-1, and they had a system where they tried to grade their questions from 1 to 10, and the idea was meant to be that if it was a 10 out of 10 question, it meant that 10 people out of 10 ought to get that one correct. And if it was only a 1 in 10 question, it would be only one person in 10 would get it correct. Then when I started looking through the database, you'd find some questions that were like, such and such a wine is created with which grape? And it'd be like Voignier or something. And it would be rated like 7 out of 10. And I would get like, I don't think 7 out of 10 have even heard of Voignier.
Heard of Voignier, exactly, yeah.
The mind be able to pluck that out of the air. And I sort of asked, what's going on there? And they said, unfortunately what happens is that the question writers know that because they need so many easy questions in the early part of the show, they know that anything north of about 7 and certainly anything north of 5 hardly ever gets used, because they don't need the harder questions because people knock themselves out before then anyway. So what happens is that sort of like this sort of weird sort of deflation effect started to happen, where people would grade their questions as if they were easier and easier and easier to increase the chance of them getting used on the show, which wasn't terribly helpful, unfortunately.
No.
So you had to kind of recalibrate your scale according to what had happened in the past rather than by definition had happened according to the raw definition that they were supposed to be using.
That's interesting. And presumably, as well as those kinds of levels, you then have all the different ways in which you calibrate from the structure of the questions. So, for example, you've got the number of options. So if you've only got one option, that's fine. But if it's multiple choice of 3 or 4 or whatever, then that starts to enable you to turn the dial one way or the other.
Yep, you can build in clues. I mean, I think an interesting exercise would be to take a sort of a very basic fact like the Mona Lisa in the Louvre and try and write a question from all the way from 1 to 10, because I think it would be doable.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like
That's probably true. I mean, you know, because you can start, again, there's that kind of narrowing of things, isn't it? So you can say, you know, which country or which European country. So going with the Mona Lisa, you could say, you know, which painting in Paris, you know, or which painting by, and so on and so on. And each of those steps starts to limit the number of possible answers.
So yeah, it's difficult. You have to try and take a middle view sometimes and go, well, I know this is a common fact that comes up in quizzes, but just that it means it's still fairly obscure.
But I think the other reason why you kind of need these conventions is that as question writers, if you're going to be playful as a question writer, then that's what you play with. So if you're playing with multiple choice, for example, you know, you don't just put down four equal types of answers. You know, you have answers that get a laugh, you know, two answers that it could be, and, you know, and that kind of stuff. That, or you do your swerve technique. I remember I did a grid for Only Connect, and I was quite proud of the fact that on the board there were four rabbits from Watership Down. I think they were Fiver, Hazel, Silver and Dandelion, I think they were. And that wasn't the answer to, that wasn't the question to any of the groups. But it was a trap.
Yeah.
Which people fell into joyfully.
But what sometimes can happen is that some people are extraordinarily evil. I'm pretty sure I saw one which had about six or seven Monopoly tokens in it. None of which were in any. There was never a Monopoly tokens group at all.
Yes,
that really does burn time, because people think, well, if there's six of these things, then that we must have to try and combo the correct four. And there's a lot of. There's probably about 24 different ways of choosing.
Yeah.
No, is it 30? 50, it's probably 15 ways of choosing four from six in some order. So that's nasty.
So what do you do? I mean, when members of the public write in and they say this question was really unfair because, I mean, what is the comeback?
Well, one of my friends says that quiz is mimetic, okay. Which means that...
One of your friends would say that.
Yes. Well, he is one of the strongest quizzes in the UK. Well, there we go. He would know what that meant. Exactly. But I believe it's
something
means...
to do with diarrhea, isn't it?
Yeah, you take three aspirin a day for it.
Yeah.
So you it's effectively quiz kind of eats itself. So what happens is something that used to be a really neat fact, like say the Scoville unit is the scale used to measure the heat of chili peppers.
Right.
That would be a really clever, smart, interesting fact that might come out on a quiz or in a Trivial Pursuit con one day, and then that just keeps getting asked so many times on other quizzes that it then starts to become a part of quiz canon. And that might be something now that appears on a fairly average sort of, you know, as question fodder or something like The Weakest Link or something of that ilk. There's probably an unfairness in terms of, like, just because certain questions have been asked in the past means it has to be asked in the future. I think there's like whole ranges of stuff that probably ought to have more questions asked about it. I think particularly computer games, given that it's bigger than film and music combined, doesn't seem to get much of a look in, but it's seen as too niche for quizzes and often board games to some extent, I think.
But is that because it's binary, though? I mean, I get that completely. But, and I mean, maybe one is a cause or effect of the other, but the difference between, say, literature and games is that you're more likely to know incidentally something about literature than you are to know something incidentally about gaming. You'd have to be into literature to have heard of, you know, Jane Austen or whatever. Whereas, you know, a major character in the gaming world might just not have leaked into the general population.
Maybe, but I'm putting a bet on that most people in their 20s, if you look at them, more of them will have played Fallout than they would have read Persuasion. So,
yeah, they don't need to. What I mean is, they don't need to have read Persuasion because, you know, Austen pops up in so many different things. But to your point, that may be going back to things being mimetic, as it were. It may be that just because literature pops up in so many quizzes and so on, that it becomes a, you know, it becomes something you can make a joke about, or something you can build robots about, or you can have Jane Austen world on a sci-fi series and that kind of thing.
What you can guarantee is that when you try and I did a series called Quizmaster, where we were trying to find questions that like the best quizzes in the country couldn't answer. And so everyone was getting really excited because they're going to go, oh, we could really ask them some really tricky questions about things like rap music. And and I was saying to them, like, the one thing you can guarantee these people are absolute experts on is rap music, because they know that is the sort of thing where it comes up so often in quizzes, and everybody expects them not to know about stuff like that. And it's those things that they are absolute world-class experts on. So, it's often the weird questions that like just come from nowhere that seem to fool them. I remember a question on eggheads once, which was, from which part of an animal do we get meat? Is it the muscle, the ligaments, or the tendons?
Ooh.
And that completely sideswiped them.
Well,
which one would you guess for that?
The muscle, the ligaments, or the tendons? I would say the muscle.
Yeah, because they're the big mass. They're the heaviest bit. And they got that one wrong. I think the other team won as a result of it. And it's... I mean, like the ligaments and tendons.
It's a very good question.
The ligaments and tendons are just too stringy in order, and they're not very edible anyway. But yeah, it was just because it's not mimetic. It's not a question that's the sort of thing that they've had to learn in the past. It means that it greatly increases the chance of them being able to answer it through stuff that they've learned before.
Yeah.
So that's basically it. I think essentially, question producers, they judge question difficulty based on things that have gone before, or if it's not possible to do that, then by how much of an expert you expect it to be.
And a little bit of the ability to work it out, I guess, as well.
Yeah. Well, how you work out questions, or what methods you can put in for...
That's a whole other topic.
That's a whole question. We can do that next week.
Okay. Right.
Now let's return to our interview with quiz show producer Julia Hobbs. I just find it interesting setting up new shows, and you often worked for new productions for a series of things. So how do you attune to writing questions for a show that, like, even maybe the producer's not entirely sure what they want from it?
Yeah, that's quite difficult. I've done it twice, worked on a new series. I did it with Decimate, the very first series of Decimate. And the one that I've just finished actually is brand new first series. So you have to be prepared for lots of in-studio changes.
Yeah.
You know, you think things are going one way and then something comes along that makes it clear that things are not going to work the way you thought they would. So, I mean, this new show that I've just finished, for example, we had a lovely set of options that would have been beautiful to use on the show, but it just wouldn't work because all we had was the options were motorway service station or National Trust property. and all we could do was put the names in of either or, which was just considered just a bit too bald and a bit too, you know, there was nothing to sort of play with within the questions. So that was a learning process. I think initially they started off wanting things to be quite short and sharp, statement-y in the question options. But then it was sort of decided a bit further on that they wanted, you know, them to be a bit more questiony and a bit more fun and, you know, have a bit more to them. So sort of going back to bulk out the things that had been written early on that were just quite short statements, that was, you know, it's quite time consuming. And sometimes the execs will decide they want things a one way and it just doesn't, you know, it makes life a lot harder. On the first series of Decimate, for example, I don't know if you remember Decimate.
Hmm.
So Decimate was a series on BBC Daytime that was players of, I think it was three players, presented with a list of keywords, and each of those words formed part of the questions that they would be answering. And so they'd get the keywords, decide which of them wanted to play because they took turns to play, and then they could get so far and they could pass back for an answer if they wanted, or they could swap positions with someone else in their team to have a go. And they had to work their way kind of around a wall, an illuminated wall with 10 columns on. And if they got questions right, obviously they'd get whatever was in the column. And if they got questions wrong, the column would fall and that would be the decimate. And then they'd just have to start again. But the execs decided they wanted each of those keywords to be unique for that entire series. So we couldn't repeat any question. So if we had two questions, for example, completely different questions about mountains, we couldn't have mountain more than once as a keyword. And that made life quite difficult, especially when we were getting towards the end of building the sets of questions. It was quite tricky to do that. Yeah. So a first series, tricky, but lots of fun. It's good to be involved at the beginning and feel like you've got agency in the way a show is made. You know, coming into a series, a number of series in, is also great because things work in a certain way and you can just slot into it and figure out how things go. But it is exciting to be part of a new show, yeah, from the beginning.
You said something about questions giving you something to play with, and that just struck me again that because, you know, we're making entertainment all of the time, and also because we very often hire comedians to present these shows, I guess another role of the question and the answer is something for them to riff off. So again, how much, if at all, do you work with the script writers, or do they just get the questions and then go into the kind of writer's room to figure out some funnies to relate to it? How much of an interplay is there?
Actually, none in any of the shows I've ever worked on.
Right. Interesting.
We've never had any kind of crossover between the question team and the writing, and the, you know, writers for the presenter. They do their thing and we do ours. And if they gel, then that's kind of, it's a happy accident more often than not. But in most cases, in my experience, I think the presenters can generally be relied on to kind of find their own path, if you like, and just sort of see where the fun is and where to pick up and what to riff off and so on. And obviously some presenters are better at it than others. But yeah, it's interesting. We don't have any, like, script writers, comedy writers don't see any questions beforehand.
But in the back of your mind, if you're writing down a question for something, and there's a bit of your brain that's thinking, that could be a double entendre, or that could be taken another way, or that's a funny word, or that's a surname of an inventor that someone could riff off. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that's always going through my mind, always through all the minds of all the question writers I've worked with as well. Absolutely. At The Chase in particular, there are a couple of writers who make it their mission, really, to try and fit as much entendre as they can, as much innuendo as they can into all of their questions. And sometimes you go, no, that's a step too far. And sometimes you just sort of go, yeah, we can get away with that, you know. And then the execs might see it and go, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. Bradley will corpse completely at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Or we'll get letters from people.
Mm. How many questions have they written about the Wankel rotary engine and stuff like that?
I'm sure I've seen some. I don't know how many. Beavers pop up a lot as well. Especially on The Chase. Yeah.
I've had quite a few presenters who desperately want to know the answers to the questions before they ask them. And I've always been quite strict that they're not allowed to know the answers because it changes the way they ask them.
That's true. I think that is true. But actually, my experience is that they, you know, some presenters will want to see the questions beforehand, not necessarily to know the answers, but just so that they can get a clearer idea in their head of what to expect. On The Chase in particular, Bradley definitely doesn't see the multiple choice questions. He doesn't see those. What he says on the show about them coming out and him not seeing them, him seeing them at the same time as the contestants is absolutely true. He doesn't. So everything you get from him on that part of the show is completely genuine. And the answer run that I've just finished with, the presenter didn't want to see the questions at all. So he was absolutely seeing everything at the same time as the contestants. Yeah.
Another show you've worked on as question producer and edit producer, I believe, is Pointless.
Yep.
Now, obviously that involves list questions. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's always I'm curious about is that some of these might have a large number of answers, like 120 answers or something. And the standard practice in a lot of quizzes is to double source everything. So does that mean that sometimes you have to go to the extreme of getting two sources for each for 120 different items? Or are there shortcuts?
No, unless we were citing a source in the question. For example, film questions are sourced by IMDb, and Richard would say at the top of the question, you know, films that Tom Cruise has starred in according to IMDb as of, and give the date. So for the most of those kind of things, that was enough. But yeah, for plenty of other questions, you would have to double source. Two lines of source in each list option. And it's quite tricky and time consuming.
It's a lot of work for 7 minutes of telly.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
And what counts as a source? Or what doesn't count as a source?
Wikipedia definitely doesn't count as a source.
Mm.
Because of its general nature of being user edited, it's often used as a jumping off point and as a very quick check. You know, in studio, if I've got to look something up quickly, I'll probably go there first and then go somewhere else to double check it, just because it's the quickest way of doing things. But they have to be authoritative sources. So for music questions, it's always the Official Charts Company. For films, as I say, IMDb. For nature questions, you can go to RSPB, National Geographic are very good for that sort of thing. Britannica are good, but we have come across the occasional slip up in Britannica, but it is regarded as authoritative. So, you know, if you can find official sources for film, music, TV, as I say, nature, that sort of thing, science, the IUPAC, for example, for chemical element questions, which Pointless is very fond of, as I'm sure you've noticed. It's always the IUPAC that they are sourced from. Hence the spelling of sulfur with an F rather than sulfur with a PH, which sends people into absolute conniptions even now. Even though that standard was adopted over 30 years ago, people are still cross about it.
One thing I particularly admire about The Chase is just the fact it's been going so long, and therefore they've had to get through so much material. And I always think it's easy to write a difficult question, and it's very, very hard to write something that's an entertaining, an accurate, simple question. Because you could argue there's fewer simple things to know, because the pool of stuff to ask about is less.
That's true. I mean, on The Chase, because it's been going for so long, the most basic questions can be repeated, you know, several series apart. But it is surprisingly difficult to come up with the more basic stuff. It's very tricky. And I often say it's one of the hardest parts of the job is actually gauging difficulty and taking that step back from what you know and then assuming what other people know. You can't assume, I mean, you would assume that everyone knows what the capital of France is, but you don't know. There might be somebody out there who doesn't. You might assume that everyone watches Coronation Street and they know all the characters or they know plot lines from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. I would, but someone half my age probably wouldn't. And that's the thing, is you've got to keep in mind the audience age, the audience demographic, that sort of thing. And it is tricky. And as you're right, David, it is difficult coming up with easy, basic questions without making them insultingly easy.
But that brings us a little bit onto what general knowledge is, because as people get more siloed in their knowledge, and as they make choices about what they study and things earlier and earlier, all of those different kinds of things, that actually people coming to these types of shows have less of a general knowledge than they used to.
I wouldn't say less general knowledge necessarily. I'm often surprised at what people don't know, especially younger people. But at the same time, things that are being taught in schools now are completely different from things that I was taught in schools. O-level biology, I did various things that I can still talk about and still remember. But I know that there are people much younger than me who've learned completely different. It strikes me more in science than anything else. You know, I know people that can, off the top of their heads, name all the elements in a particular group on the periodic table, and that just makes me go, wow. And they know all about genetics, DNA, all of the proteins that make up DNA, and I have no clue about any of this because it's not something that we were taught at school as a matter of course. But I think now that it is, it blows my mind a little bit, because I think they sort of consume knowledge in a different way, I think, from the way that I did as a kid and as I was going through my education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was actually at my best friend's house the other night, and she has two teenagers who were talking about history and we happened to get onto the subject of JFK, and they sort of knew a little bit about JFK's assassination, but not very much. Although they're being taught modern history, they know more about 9/11 than they do about JFK's assassination, for example, because that's sort of much more, I suppose, relevant to their sphere.
Particularly with pop culture, quizzing go-tos like the cast of Only Fools and Horses and stuff like that, that's now starting to show its age. And maybe people these days, now that the repeats have stopped, and if you don't happen to catch UK Gold, those sorts of common touch points are there no longer for questions to be asked about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all got our staples that we go to. Only Fools and Horses is a very good example. I've got another question writing friend who's a big Dad's Army fan. He likes to put lots of Dad's Army questions in. I think, David, possibly you might know who I'm talking about. And so, yeah, all the things that we have grown up with, other people, you know, I'm perplexed that people don't know that David Jason played Del Boy, or that people don't even know who Del Boy is, for example. And at the same time, they know everything there is to know about Game of Thrones or all of the fantasy things that are on Netflix, that are on Disney Plus, etc., which I sort of can get a handle on, but I've never watched Game of Thrones. So I everything I know about Game of Thrones, I know from quiz, not from watching it. And it's the same with Harry Potter for me, actually. I've never read a Harry Potter book, seen any of the films, but I know more about it than I have any right to because of my job. Yeah.
Well, one thing about quizzing is it will always evolve, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Julia, you'll be back for Show and Tell later, but for now, Julia Hobbs, thanks very much for joining us on TV Show and Tell.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here in the UK, the reboot of Gladiators has been doing brilliant business for the BBC. And in news that will shock no one, it's been recommissioned for a second series. The world's easiest recommissioning decision ever, I imagine. Anyway, there was something interesting that you spotted about the way that this series has ended and played out in terms of the tournament structure, Justin.
Yes, well, it goes back a little bit to our discussion about fairness, I guess, but in a different kind of way. So in the men's final, which has happened, and I won't give away the result, but in the men's final, Wesley Mayle was pitted against a guy called Finlay Anderson. And when it became apparent that that's who was going to be in it, some fans cried foul because they pointed out that Wesley wasn't even in the contest when the show began. So what happened was that another Finlay called Finlay Burkitt, was in the eliminator heat of the quarterfinals. He suffered a knee injury, and so he was replaced by Wesley Mayle. And some people felt right there and then that it wasn't right that somebody who hadn't taken part in the heats should then come into the show. They felt that it should have been the second runner-up who came into the show at that point. So anyway, Mayle comes into the show to replace Finley Burkitt, and therefore ends up in the finals, having not been in the beginning of the show and having not taken part in the heats. On top of that, there was another slight quirk, which was that in the quarterfinals, Mail played against Finley Anderson and beat him then. Right. So basically, some fans felt that neither Anderson nor Mail should have been in the final, since both, you know, one hadn't been there at the beginning and the other one had been beaten by the person who wasn't there at the beginning. So it threw up for me the challenges there are when you have, in this instance, a structure where it's a very physical game. There are a lot of potential for injury. It's almost certain there are going to be some injuries and people having to withdraw. And how then you construct a competition that's fair?
Well, yeah, I suppose with the gladiators, there's two main issues, isn't there? I mean, one is like, if somebody has already recorded a show recently, if you were to try and invite them back and say, oh, actually a place has opened back up for you, can you do it again, but maybe they only just competed on yesterday's recording, they might not necessarily feel that they have 100% energy levels to do it all again the day after.
Yeah.
And also there's a link, isn't there, about how tired you are and the risk to injury. That might have been a consideration, that like getting somebody who's fresh and ready to go might be safer, even though it's less fair. And then there's the whole thing, of course, availability. It's not a guarantee that that person was going to be available on that day to record again. They might have been expected to sort of go, well, I've got the train back to Bristol, and they're trying to get me all the way back to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, as with all of these things, I mean, some of it comes down to the fact that everyone signs up to the same rules. So, by definition, as a replacement contestant, Wesley Mail had already, you know, failed to get into the competition, and therefore, you know, the others had managed to get into the competition. So he already had a disadvantage at that point. But I suppose it raises the question again of, well, at what point would you activate that rule? You know, in other words, he was brought in to take part in the quarterfinals. Had it been the semifinals and somebody had gone out with injury, would they have done the same thing? Had it been the final and somebody had gone out, would they have done the same thing? So, you know, then question of at what point, you know, where on the scale do you activate the rule?
Because the scheduling is interesting, because they were playing around with the scheduling a little bit from what we've been able to work out. I think it was pointed out that both semifinals was recorded on the same day, which is interesting because it's a long record with big resets between large scale games. So it's not an easy thing to record two of in a day, which I think is the reason why they had the same set of games for the both semis, because I think what ended up happening was that they would effectively record the wall for semi-final one and then the wall for semi-final two at once, and then reset to the next game. And then they would obviously cut all the program one stuff for the first show and all the program two stuff for the second stuff. But it was sort of shot in a completely different order.
And I don't think it also, I mean, my memory is it wasn't actually shown in complete order as well. So in other words, they went through from the heats to the quarterfinals with some people and then went back to the heats, so that it wasn't too long since you last saw certain people. Given that it's on weekly, you know, if you go through the heats, you could, by the time you get to the quarterfinals, you've completely forgotten who these people are.
As we've said in the past, like the way that you treat contestants in terms of managing their expectations of how long they have to take off work, how many nights you have to book for their hotels, for their travel arrangements, how flexible that has to be, which is all money off screen, and therefore it's eats up budget for no extra benefit. a lot of daytime quizzes have this issue in terms of like how much do you reuse contestants before you get rid of them. I mean, like in the old 15-1, people 15 contestants would arrive in the studio and several of them would have left after getting two questions wrong, and then they'd be on the train back to Glasgow, and that would be it. Whereas in the when they did the remake, you'd have several goes before you'd got to rejected. And then in terms of sort of how you manage the headcount and things like University Challenge and Only Connect, how many teams do you need and who do you get rid of at which stage? The BBC imposes from on high that to say, oh, this year we're going to give you 28 weeks. And it's up to you to work out what convoluted structure of knockout, double elimination, mini tournament that you need in order to ensure that you end up with the right number. And then there might be some specials you might be allowed to use at the end. But effectively, you've got to work out the maths of the situation.
Yes, because for a normal standard knockout championship, it's basically 8, 15 or 31.
It's one less than a power of two. So it's 7, 15 or 31. Yeah, right.
Because I know that I just actually very recently you wrote some notes for me years ago on double eliminations, which I've had to go back to propose an arced series for something that's a standalone series, but it's also got to fit into a very odd number of of episodes. I was sitting there scratching my head thinking, I don't know how to do this. I thought, actually, I remember that a very long time, it was 2015, David explained double eliminations to me, and I went back and checked my notes, and there they were, which I've just actually sent to people. So it can be very difficult.
And also you have this issue in terms of formatting with things like if you reset after the end of each week, if you have like a bunch of people and then like somebody leaves but somebody new comes in, then is it fair on the person that's arrived on for Friday's show that they've effectively only got one shot of taking part and making their way to the final? I mean, I suppose the Price is Right thing, when they do the bids, so that the people who start the show, the first four people, they get to bid on each item to try and get their way onto the main stage. But for the last pricing game, the person that's just come down the stairs to fill the empty slot, they only have that one item to try and get onto the stage. I suppose it's a thing of what's the difference between just and fair? I mean, like, if those first four contestants were the best people you interviewed, and therefore you want to make the most of them, you have fairly justly chosen them to be the stars of the show. And then if the other people are not nearly quite as good, but they're okay, then it's reasonable that you put your seventh best contestant on as
And I think because our casting processes are very good, frankly, it's rare to beyond rare that somebody who is brought in as a substitute, as it were, actually wins these shows. Because they aren't the best, you know, they may or may not be the most entertaining, but they aren't necessarily perceived by the production through the casting process to be the ideal candidates, and that usually, more than usually, plays out in the results.
So it's welcome back to Julia Hobbs, and it's show and tell time. So what object have you brought to show us?
I have brought a copy of the Daily Mirror, which contains a particular comic strip, and I wrote a question about this particular comic strip for the celebrity version of The Chase, which went down very well indeed with both Bradley Walsh and the person that was answering the question. And the question is, what is the German name for the comic strip character Andy Kapp? And the options were Dick Tingler, Helmut Schmacker, or Willy Wacker. And the answer is Willy Wacker. And I was very glad that this particular question was answered by a certain Tim Vine, and he found it very funny indeed. And it probably is one of my career highlights. I have several career highlights, but that's right up there. Making Tim Vine laugh with one of my questions, and Bradley thought it was hilarious too. So, yeah.
How long did that Q&A last on screening with the two? Just trying to imagine the two of them gifted that kind of material in front of them.
Yeah, it did. It did go down very well, and it sort of it wasn't quite Fanny Schmeller level, but it was, you know, it was close. Yeah, they did a good job with it. Let's say they had fun, and the audience loved it as well. Yeah, it went down very well.
Oh yes, because of course this is the celebrity version, so that you have a proper live audience. In
yes, they do. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And what time of day did this go out?
The Celebrity Chase goes out in the evenings. It's prime time. So on the Celeb Chase, they can get away with a little bit more slightly naughty, use slightly naughty questions. Yeah.
Well, that's brilliant. So thanks again, Julia, for joining us on TV Show and Tell.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
And finally, it's 4 minute format time. So I have splashed out on a new piece of paper. Got six brand new words here today for Justin to choose between. So which one would you like?
I'd like number three, please, Bob.
Number three. It is the word rival. Rival.
Okay.
So we have 4 minutes to come up with a format inspired by that word, and it starts now.
Well, it's a very attractive word, isn't it? It makes me think, first of all, of dating shows, dating competitions, I guess, specifically, because a rival in love is...
Oh, I see.
Well, you see, it's where, of where you work. So I think of X on the Beach, for example, is a rival show, you know, where you go on the dating show, you start dating people, and then your exes start arriving by boat to be a rival to your new love.
I just remember there wasn't a Pop Stars series called The Rivals.
It was Pop Stars The Rivals, yes. Yeah. So the first series was Building the Pop Stars, which became Hearsay, and the second series was building two pop groups that then competed against each other.
As if the music industry isn't competitive enough. Yeah. So you've got yet another person to be competitive against in order to even win that.
Yeah. So rival for your affection is one thing. Obviously a rival contestant, but that's so broad that, you know, any contestants in a competition are rivals.
Especially if you have rival ideologies or rival ideas for something, rival...
Yes. I mean, The Apprentice is people, you know, rivals, you know, similar types competing for the same job. So I guess the question then is, you know, these are all the obvious things. So what's the kind of clever spin on rival?
I'm going to look up the definition of rival.
Okay. So are we allowed to do that?
Well, yes. It's our game. So it says here, noun, rival, the contestant you
hope... I think that's unfair. Sorry, go on.
I'm sure dictionaries are allowed in most development offices.
Right, go.
And then someone or something with a similar quality as another. Oh, interesting. Right. So the given example here, as a social historian, he has no rival. So does that mean that you could take two people that are quite similar in what they know, and so it's kind of almost like a bit like Mastermind, but they it's like two academics that are all like the rivals in a particular field.
There is that. I mean, it would be quite interesting if you've got two rivals in a field, an academic field rather than a field, who ask each other questions. That's the game, is whether they can catch each other out.
Outsmarted,
yes.
Yes.
Now, obviously, that might leave us, the viewer, behind very, very quickly. However, it could also, you could take the line, going back to something you said before about quizzers who know everything about rap because that's the subject that they think they're going to be asked to be trying to be caught out on, maybe each of them is given topics that they've got to answer their, got to put to their rival, which they think their rival won't know anything about. So there could be home questions and away questions, is my point. So you could, the home questions could be, you know, I'm an aeronautic engineer and so are you, and I'm going to answer ask you questions to try and catch you out. But I also get to ask you away questions from a list.
Yeah.
Where I think, well, you don't know anything about children's animation, so I'm going to try and catch you out that way.
There we go.
Outsmarted. Well, it's a good title.
That's well, all right. That's our time up. So I think that is what we're going to go with.
So is there going to be a YouTube channel of all our 4-minute formats? I think we need to get them out there, you know, before somebody else does. I'm sure there's probably pilots being made all over the world.
Some sort of catalogue for MIP. Well, if that area still exists in the coming months, but yes, for MIP London next year, we should have a page in there.
Yeah,
online brochure of all of our 4-minute formats.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can tweet us at TV Show Podcast, or you can email us at contact@tvshowandtell.com. But until next time, I've been David Boddicombe.
And I've been Justin Scroggie.
And this has been TV Show and Tell.